We're gonna chill, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
All right. I'm good at making friends. Give me your phone.
I love this.
Do you know who this is?
Yes, yeah, it's Spotify. So it's
Ball to open.
Yes. And what do you do?
Info dump and busk.
Freestyle.
Boom.
A gathering. You're all here.
Could be fun.
And one in addition.
This time there's three of us.
Stop busking.
Knock on wood. Do what I can.
Here come the drums.
Hello and welcome to Pull to Open, an ongoing quest to watch every single episode of the entire television program Doctor Who in random order. I'm Pete Paschal.
And I'm Chris Taylor. And Pete, knock knock.
Who's there?
It's our very special guest for our very special episode of Pull to Open, journalist and broadcaster, as they used to say in the old days, Brian Young. Welcome.
Hey, Brian.
Oh, no, thank Brian. You. Thank you for Brian, having me.
Thank you for coming on. Brian, I know from my other life as a Star Wars guy, and he and I have had many, many discussions over the years. We've shown up at many premieres. I've been on the Full of Sith podcast, followed that from its initiation. And Brian, you've done roughly 600 Fulls of Sith?
Pulls of Sith? Yeah, something like that. We've been...
We combine the podcasts, yes.
Yeah, we've been podcasting on Full of Sith since for 10 years now. Almost 10 and a half, I think. So yeah, I think we've got over 600 releases on our feed, and you're part of at least a dozen of them.
I gotta get back on. We gotta get back into Star Wars mode. But today we're in Doctor Who mode, and you have done something, Pete and I are journalists who've written about Doctor Who in the past. But you've done a little bit more than just writing about it. You've been part of the licensed content of Enterprises. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the Rittenhouse Archive, which is a manufacturer of trading cards, has picked up the Doctor Who license to do those trading cards, and I'm writing all of them. So as far as has been released so far... Season 11 and 12 with Jodie Whittaker, and the Christopher Eccleston and David Tennant years, and I've worked on some more beyond that. And they're really fun, and they're a much different challenge. I write a lot of Star Wars trading cards too, and those are a little easier, where they just kind of give you a title and maybe a movie reference or a character or whatever, and I can just write that out. But with the Doctor Who cards, it's really fascinating, where they say, we just want three cards for every episode, or six in the case of the specials, and you need to, or me, I mean, no one's doing this but me, summarize it in three 100-word chunks to make three cards, or six 100-word chunks for the specials. And it's taught me so much about storytelling and how to condense things, because you want to get the big sweep of each of the episodes on each card. And I have a huge fondness for the trading cards as well. That was like when I was a kid, that was one of the only things I could afford when I was collecting stuff. So I started by collecting Star Wars trading cards and Batman trading cards and Ninja Turtles and that sort of thing. And so back then in the 80s, that was a really key way to like interact with the stories and learn more details and things like that. So I've been trying to, as I go through it, not just summarize, but add detail that maybe might not have been spoken in the episode or things like that, so that people reading the cards might learn something extra about Doctor Who or Star Wars or whatever else I'm working on.
You know, it's funny you knowing that you're kind of a Star Wars guy, because as I was growing up in the 80s, the trading card, what you were just saying there about sort of having that avenue to interact with it, it resonates so much with it. I remember those Return of the Jedi trading cards you could get especially, and you could like came with like bubble gum or whatever. And but like I growing up in Canada, like there was I think an expectation that I was supposed to be into hockey cards, which I kind of was a little bit. But when Star Wars cards came out, I was like, oh yeah, baby, like this is my thing. It's really cool to hear that like that's sort of ongoing, and like now even more generations can do it, even though I don't think they could get it at their local convenience store like I used to anymore.
Yeah, no, the market for trading cards is definitely very different from when I was a kid, and that was a really interesting world to step into, especially with the way they package them now. And it's the same across Doctor Who, and it's the same across Star Wars and everything, is that there's chase cards, right? So you'll have your base set of cards, and then you'll have like a version with a different color or a gold foil stamp on it or something, and there's only 25 of those cards, or autograph cards, right? Actually, I bought a few boxes of the Doctor Who cards I got that I wrote, and actually I was really fortunate enough to pull a Jodie Whittaker autograph out of it. So there's nice. All kinds of really cool stuff in them, and it sort of changed the economics of them, so they're so much more expensive than they were. I mean, I was used to paying like 50 cents for a pack in a used bookstore, right? Sure. So now paying a hundred bucks for a box of, 20 packs or whatever it is astronomical in my view. But
is there a dream a dream card for you to work on within Doctor Who that you haven't yet? Like maybe or something like that?
You know, I'm a huge Matt Smith fan, and getting to do all of his stuff was really fun. And I got to do the episodes for the 50th anniversary special, and those were really fun to work on. I hope that I'll get a chance to go back and do a lot of the classic stuff. My connection with the classic stuff was like, oh, it's way too late. I'm up past my bedtime and PBS BBC is right. on now. And I would love a reason to go back and sort of be forced to go through all of those episodes in the best way possible. I love them, but I haven't watched them as encyclopedically as I have the newer stuff, which I've really enjoyed.
Yeah, if you had six cards for a classic story, I think five of them would be running through corridors, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah, it's interesting.
A corridor would be a card in every set, yes.
It's interesting to think about how that might be broken up. It might be more something like two cards per episode, and then you'd get probably, eight cards for a whole arc, or 10 cards, right, or depending on how long the arc is. I wonder how they'd do that. That's all up to the whims of the BBC and the licensor and whoever else. And I'm just sort of the guy they call in to do the breakdowns, but it would be an interesting challenge.
I'm already imagining getting the full set for Trial of a Time Lord would be insane.
Oh my God.
Yeah. 50 cards, the special foil pack. For each single episode here. Oh, man.
And then the Mel card just appears randomly in every deck, and nobody knows how it got there. Yes, little Trial of a Time Lord joke. Well, speaking of forcing functions that force us to go through the entire classic series, that's kind of what we've been doing here on Pull to Open, doing a lot of stuff that is new to me. Let's take it back, Pete, if you will, with the previously on, and tell us about the classic series episodes that we were exiled to.
Absolutely. So first of all, guys, yes, we are going to going to have a commentary about an episode here. It's coming up, and just to set that up, previously on Pull to Open, we have been in space a lot. A few episodes ago, we were at the Ark in Space, a very well-regarded episode of the Tom Baker era, where the Weirin nearly took over all of humanity, but believe it or not, the Doctor did stop them.
There were bugs in that episode. I'm just going to point that out.
Scary bugs.
Possible foreshadowing.
Big bugs, too. And we fled the bugs, ended up in another era of the future, in a little adventure called Frontier in Space in the John Pertwee era, where we got to see the early Earth Empire and how the Master was manipulating it to go to war with another empire. But then there was a third empire that was going to take over. And go ahead and listen to that podcast to get the spoiler on that. I won't do it again here. Yes.
Spoiler alert on a 50-year-old show. Yes.
But again, the randomizer has been obsessed with the future lately, because after Frontier in Space, it took us to the Mutants, an earlier adventure in the Third Doctor Adventures, but later in the Earth Empire was the decline of that empire. And we got to see mutants on a weird space colony. And at the end of that one,
yeah,
Chris actually asked the randomizer. Also say,
by the way, mutants turning into butterflies that could also be seen as bugs.
Yeah, they were very bug-like. Yeah. They had mandibles, weird claws, etc.
Yeah, that's true.
But I remember at the end of that podcast, Chris, you had asked the randomizer to take us to the randomizer's favorite doctor. And man, did it deliver, because of course it took us immediately to an adventure involving Peter Capaldi, the 12th Doctor, and it is Series 10, Episode 4, Knock Knock.
Knock Knock, indeed. Kind of surprising that we haven't, you know what, it wasn't until we did this story that I realized the inherent joke in the title, Knock Knock.
Really? Took you this one? Well, I'm glad.
It took me until the second viewing, many years later, from 2017, which is when this is on, when I saw it the first time, to like, oh, yeah, oh, the next line is who's there. Oh, I get it. Okay. But yeah, the randomizer loves Capaldi. The randomizer especially loves Capaldi's Series 10.
Mm-hmm. Because we've done
Smile, which had connections to the Ark in Space. We've done Oxygen, which is one after this. Pyramid of the End of the World, Lie of the Land, that was an early one, and The Eaters of Light. I mean, mm-hmm. It's possible that Season 10 may be our first season bingo.
Could be. Need a few more in there. We need the pilot. Yeah. We need some stuff with Masters later on. But yes, Series 10, it's a popular one.
Yeah, especially so just before we jump into the feedback loop, Brian, was this one you watched at the time? Were you on board with Capaldi at the time, or you're catching up now?
So, I'll be honest. Like, this is the first episode of season 10 I've watched. I watched Capaldi's first two seasons, and then whatever was happening with my cable, kind of like I didn't know where to find it. And then I picked back up with Jodie Whittaker. So this is like this weird hole in my Doctor Who that I haven't picked up yet. And I was showing Valkyrie, my youngest kid, Doctor Who, and we were taking her through it. And we got to Capaldi and she sort of just checked out. And this was about a year ago. So we got like three episodes into his new run, and I was like, I was planning to catch up then, and then she checked out. But she watched this with me for this, and she was like, why didn't we finish this? And I was like, that is an excellent question. So this episode was good enough for an eight-year-old to go, actually, I think I've misjudged Capaldi.
Aww.
Nice.
Not in those words, but generally.
That is so really cool. Awesome. As regular listeners know, we do have a regular segment where Pete talks about his kids viewing Doctor Who. So we'll definitely get to the childhood view on Knock Knock, a very deliberately scary watch it behind the sofa kind of story. But yeah, we'll get there first.
Yeah. Penis. Well, let me just first of all say, no, go ahead. You
did. Plunge the feedback loop.
Before we plunge into
the show notes.
Yeah, that's right. Before we go to the feedback loop, I know we're a little late on this, guys, to give you the notice, but if you're just here for the commentary on Knock Knock, go ahead and check the show notes for the time code on when that commentary begins. Sorry we didn't get the reminder in earlier. But for those who are listening now, let's go right into the feedback loop. All right, well, got listeners, as you know, one of the best ways to show your appreciation for this year's podcast, Pull to Open, is to leave a review, of course, in the podcast app you're listening in, especially Apple Podcasts. And guys, I don't think we said this. This is the 100th episode of Pull to Open. So if you were waiting for your signal to leave a review for this podcast, here we are. We've done 100 of these things, guys. Come on. That's it's right. Okay. Show some appreciation. Go ahead. Leave a review in your app. They really do help. That will make the show more visible to listeners who really want to get this great discussion of Doctor Who.
Yeah. 100 episodes really means that you can now do a percentage score. If you liked the episodes that you've listened to, give us that percentage, translate it into 5 stars or however many stars you think we're worth. I think 100 quality episodes translates to 5 stars.
You should share the podcast too with 100 friends, right? 100 100 episodes, you've earned 100 shares. So go ahead, just keep hitting that share button, pick up the first 100 people from your contacts list and just blast it out to them. I'm sure that's a great idea.
Yeah,
but no, sharing with a friend is a great way to show your appreciation too.
Minimum 100 friends. But also one thing you can do when you leave that review is put a Doctor Who title, the title of an episode, title of an old series story, in that review in the form of emoji. And then what Pete will do is he will describe that emoji to me and or a guest that we may have.
Yeah. Well, this is the great thing that we didn't tell Brian about. Now he's been recruited into this game show we like to call the Whomoji Challenge. Where I get to
shut behind us.
Yeah, I get to describe emojis, and they end up being Doctor Who titles. And I think you might be familiar with this one, Brian.
Okay,
I've even done a card on it, perhaps.
Oh.
So we'll do we'll do this in a second. Are you guys ready?
As I'll ever be.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't. We don't seem to have been supplied with buzzers, but that's okay. I've seen Brian in a Star Wars quiz situation before, and he's lethal. So
you're the one person who witnessed that victory on that cruise ship that time.
Oh, nice! That one time. Story one for another time.
That Star Wars at Sea time, yes.
All right,
but yeah, if it's a one from Brian's era, from his trading card era, that
could be, could be.
That's good. All right,
guys, pencils down, and here we go. 3 emojis. First emoji, little baby with halo and wings.
Okay.
Second emoji, takeout box. Third emoji, Statue of Liberty.
Angels in Manhattan.
Boom!
Yes. Or was it Angels Take
Manhattan? Angels Take Manhattan.
Yeah, there you go. Judges,
I like the Muppets.
Judges judged it. Accurate enough. Yeah. Oh, Angels Take Manhattan. Now, there it is, folks.
Now I'm seeing emoji a challenge. Weeping Angels Muppet crossover. My goodness.
Yeah. That's... I've watched that.
Yeah, I'd watch the hell out of that. That's amazing.
Folks,
yes, RTD, call us.
Tune in next week for our next Whomoji challenge, which could be from you. By the way, that comes up, that one Whomoji challenge came to us from Gabriel Canada, who has given us a few lately. He also did the one last week with the Daemons, which Chris also got fairly quickly.
Yes. Did we decide if it was called the Demons or the Daemons or the Daemons?
I'm going with Daemons, just because I think that's what Pertwee calls it in the episode.
Okay.
So, I believe the Doctor. Which I probably shouldn't, given rule number one.
Rule number one.
But no, you two can submit a Whomoji challenge either via review or go ahead and drop us a line on social. We're at Pull to Open 63 on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or our most active social network, TikTok. You can leave one there at Pull to Open, all one word. So, folks, not only can you interact with us on those platforms, Spotify listeners, I am talking to you. You can do more there. You can rate this show, Pull to Open, or even the episode on your app. As you know, go ahead and give it a star rating. That's pretty easy. But you can also interact with us on a little something we like to call Poll to Open, because you can use the poll feature there to let us know what you think of the story that we're about to talk about. So we're talking about Knock Knock this week. But we rate the show. We're going to rate that episode as either a good episode, a bad episode, a so-so episode. We have the special ratings for that, Daleks, Ogrons, etc. We'll explain all that at the end of the show. But you too can go in your app and give your rating. So go ahead and do that, and we will talk about it at a future podcast like we're about to do now. So I mentioned we were recently at Frontier in Space. We have some results for Frontier in Space. All right. That's so exciting. It looks like...
I've not looked at these results, but yeah, you've got the latest news coming in there, Pete. Bring us.
I do. It's coming in. So, okay. There is a split, guys. An even split between the Viscount Banger, the top rating, and the Dalek. It's basically both of those are neck and neck. So some people think it's like one of the best, and some people think it is a very solid episode. There is a little bit. They're each there around 33%, whereas the Professor Hater, which of course is a not so great episode, but at least they tried something, is right around 10%. And there's actually like a fair amount of people who called it a fixed point in time, which is odd, which is that's our rating we use for like when you can't really rate it, often for reasons of nostalgia, which might be the case here, as it is from a sort of a very earlier episode of very early era of Doctor Who. So it's hard to know what these people were thinking when they gave it the fixed point in time, but I would suspect that they see problems with the story, but they freaking love that reveal probably in the last episode, which is a pretty good reveal.
So there were no Ogron votes?
No Ogron votes. Isn't that crazy?
This is the most Ogron rich, literally, episode story in Doctor Who history, and we got no Ogrons. Wow.
None. I thought it was going to skew heavily for the Ogrons. I thought it was going to be like just people just rated an Ogron just because, hey, Ogrons are in it. How often do I get a chance to rate an Ogron episode with an Ogron?
Yeah, but nobody.
Well, that's good.
Well, that's good to know. We do have a generally positive audience here on Pull to Open. We know that the people are very positive about Doctor Who. We like to keep it positive. You know, we don't like to rate anything an Ogron unless it really, really deserves it. But glad that we've got so many Frontier and Space lovers. Thank you for voting.
Cool.
And I think that's... Have we wrapped up the...
Well, I'd just like to mention... The last thing that place you can follow us, of course, is on YouTube. We're at youtube.com/pulltoopen. It really helps the show if you follow us there as well. So please check it out. Plus, you get to see all the cool stuff in our backgrounds, especially yours, Brian. We were just talking about that before we started the show. And I, whenever someone has a salacious crumb ready to cackle at whatever they're about to say, got to admire that.
Hell yeah.
Got to get one. I've only got like a Dalek that'll scream something or here in the back, but it's all good. By the way, I'm finally making up for the War Games. I got this poster from the one of the more recent Doctor Who magazines, and I didn't get it in time for our War Games podcast.
The War Games will always be with us in spirit.
Absolutely.
All right,
y'all.
The time has happened. The time has come. Yeah. To knock at the door. We're not knocking four times, but we're knocking two times. And the knock at the door is telling us that it is time for the segment that we call TLDW, Too Long Didn't Watch, or Too Long Doctor Who, in which one of us takes a minute per new Who episode, a 30 seconds per classic Who episode, to describe the story. This is New Who. We are back in the new era after a long, long exile. So it is 1 minute, and this time it is Pete. It is your turn. And
is it? Okay.
Red glow in your face tells me that you have closed all your tabs. You are flying blind here. No notes. No notes. No capes. No notes. And you, sir, have 1 minute to describe the entire plot of Knock Knock. Are you ready?
Well, I would just have one request that as I get closer to the end of the minute, can you start creaking the floorboards wherever you are? So it sounds like someone sneaking up behind me and I just really, really rush it to the end. I think that would help.
Yes, absolutely. Then you get revived at the end and it's all over. But yes, we'll creak some floorboards. Make sure to do it in binaural audio, which this episode was taped in.
Okay.
Just listen to it that way, but
save it for the commentary.
Okay. All right. We'll get there. Right. I'm just giving you a little bit of extra time, time to busk and info dump all in one. So here we go with the official pull to open summary of Knock Knock in 1 minute, starting in 3, 2, one, go.
So Bill is looking for a place to live, and she gets together with a bunch of college students, and they can't find anything that they can afford. But then this creepy landlord sort of says, hey, can you need a place to live? And he shows them his castle, and it's super cheap for some reason. So they take it, but something's going on. One of the people, something happens to him, the guy who moves in early. But then the Bill gets her stuff moved with by the doctor. He uses the TARDIS to move in there. And then he suddenly realizes something's going on here. This is a weird house that shouldn't be this cheap. There's a creepy landlord. Maybe he's old. Maybe he's seconds. Like crazy old. Who knows? He's going to stay and investigate. Bill doesn't like that initially, but sort of she reluctantly acquiesces to him doing it. And he basically finds out that there's this house which has been sort of creepily like getting rid of people every 20 years or so, is actually infected with this lice, this space lice. And it's actually because this guy is the son of this woman who has been restored by the lice into this wood form. And he realizes that he gets her, the woman to gets the woman to basically give, to kill, not kill, basically to sacrifice themselves so that the other people can live. And then Bill's flatmates are restored and they go live somewhere else.
All right. Good job. Only 20 seconds.
That was
over.
Not a good job. Don't patronize me. No, I failed. Use too many words.
I mean, this is the problem with New Who, right? They do pack so much into to less than an hour.
Well, I actually was a little optimistic going into this. I don't think there was as much. I think I like most of these TLDWs, you just end up spending way too much time on the setup when it really should have just been like summarizing, like, okay, weird house, space lice, horror movie vibes. That's it.
Yeah, the classic honey trap in TLDWs is to spend like 30 seconds on the cold open, which is not quite what you did here, but it was probably about
20.
I feel like writing the cards, I've kind of been cured of that because I have to fit the whole first third.
Yeah,
like I have to get to the big turn in 100 words on the first card. So, yeah,
so we should have had it's you rough. Do it, Brian. Yeah. You should. Jumped in on this, but no, it's a pretty tight episode. I mean, you might almost call it a bottle episode, but I mean, it is, it's a little, I think, tonally refreshing in Doctor Who, in that it sort of starts with this really mundane thing of college students trying to find a place to live and then does the whole Doctor Who thing of having the turn, of it being like, oh, this super creepy house. And obviously there's something strange afoot, but I like that they hold on to that mundanity sort of through the first act, essentially. And that it's to me, this is a really good showcase of Pearl Mackey and Bill's life and seeing her in that inner sort of everyday environment and contrasting that with like her relationship with the doctor. And so on that level it works, but it also sort of mixes in some pretty decent creepy horror vibes. I mean, I think, you know, we can talk about how all that's resolved, but I think in terms of atmosphere and the way they sort of technically realize the creepiness, I thought that all was very, very good.
So let me set up just a little bit of the background of the story. It's a 2017 story. It's as you say, Pete, that there's a lot of sort of mundane details of 2017 student life. They're listening to Spotify. We have, by the way, now a Spotify bingo. This is the only Doctor Who episode ever to mention Spotify, so we got that one.
So far.
It's also a Little Mix bingo. Have you guys ever heard of Little Mix? Did that come out of nowhere?
Wrong generation.
Yeah, well, they're supposedly the biggest girl band in the world, according to Spotify. But I'm met anyone outside the UK who's ever heard of them.
So those are the tunes they're listening to later, I guess, when they're chilling, when the doctor's chilling with the flatmates. Staying up late.
Great episode for Capaldi to not play his age, which is wonderful. Play around with his age, and the doctor's vanity in that regards. It is a little weird because the doctor is supposed to be a lecturer, a professor at the university that presumably all these students go to. Yeah, St. Luke's.
Which also was kind of famous, right? Like in the pilot, they talk about how you know, his lectures, he's been lecturing there for a long time, and that they're kind of like, his lectures are legendary or something, not quite legendary, but yeah, you'd think they would know who he is. Again, Doctor Who's never been that consistent about it, but even within the same season, you would think that would be a thing. The other thing is that Bill, I don't think they even, this is not like this is a contradiction, but she wasn't a student originally, right? Like she was, she worked in the kitchen.
That's right.
And I actually forget if she ends up becoming a student because of how she interacts with the doctor. Go ahead.
I think to answer that, though, I mean, how often in a college, colleges are huge. How often do you know the professors of a study, a field of study different from yours? And that group of students was pretty diverse in, like, why would that music student be listening to anything about the doctor, you know what I mean? Or yeah, anything he was lecturing on.
Yeah.
And
that makes sense.
Yeah. Speaking of the students, there was one guy named Harry who was supposed to be originally in the script. They don't make reference to it at all. The grandson of Harry Sullivan.
Right.
From the Tom Baker era, you know, who's in the Ark in Space. So interesting randomizer connection there. But yes, 2017, this is an episode by Mike Bartlett, who had long wanted to write for Doctor Who, as a lot of writers do. You know, Doctor Who at this stage in the UK is just sort of famous for being famous, right? David Suchet, who appears as the landlord in this episode, was famously Poirot before it, said yes to the script without even seeing it, you know, sight unseen, because it's Doctor Who and because he wanted a chance to work with Peter Capaldi again, which he'd done in Poirot. But it was very much so Mike Bartlett's a playwright. He wrote the play King Charles III, which I've actually written a story about. It was about, you know, sort of the beginning of the real King Charles III's era before it actually began.
You'd mentioned that before. Yeah.
So I've written about that and how it's nothing like the actual real King Charles III's era.
Speaking of mundanity, right?
Indeed. But he zeroed in on the mundanity. You know, he was like, I know that Stephen Moffat likes it when there are, you know, regular mundane things, like, you know, and Doctor Who has never done like houses.
The lodger. Of
houses. The lodger. Yeah, that's the thing, is that they kind of have, right? I mean, and would Blink be, you know, as powerful as it is without the haunted house aspect?
And funnily enough, the house they use here in Knock Knock is the same one they use in Blink for Western Drudlums. It just dresses up slightly differently.
Those werewolf episodes in David Tennant's early years, too, have that haunted house vibe.
Yeah, Tooth and Claw. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I mean, let's talk a little bit about the creepiness there and the horror movie vibes of this. How did you guys think did it pull it off? Is this kind of like a creepy Doctor Who episode? And, you know, obviously Doctor Who is limited to some extent in how scary it can be. And, you know, certainly you can't really have gore in the same way like a real horror movie could. But, you know, it can pull off scary stuff. How do you think this did in comparison to things like Tooth and Claw and Blink and whatever else?
I think, like I said, I watched this with my 8-year-old and I love watching their reactions or, you know, kids' reactions to it. And the way I realized, I mean, it wasn't like scary for me. They put the atmosphere together and it was like, oh, I can see, you know, intellectually how this is creepy. And it's interesting, but watching her cover her eyes and during a few different parts and then at the end go, that wasn't so scary, made me feel like they hewed that line really well, like Disney's Haunted Mansion, where it's really intense at the beginning and then structurally it releases that pressure valve so that with those younger audiences can feel like they've been through something but they could get through it. And that's where, to me, it felt like it really hewed that line really well.
Yeah. It's interesting. So I did not watch this with a kid, but I did watch it with a non-Doctor Who fan who's in her 50s and was unprepared, I think, for sort of the creepy horror vibe of this. And as soon as we start to see the lice, her question was, oh, is it gross out horror as well? Like, is it going to be like all blood and guts? They're going to digest the skeleton. So it's interesting that they disappear the bodies, which is almost creepier in a way if you don't have the gore in those scenes. But yeah, it definitely had a creepier vibe to me on the second viewing than it did on the first, possibly because I was watching it on the big screen for the first time. And not like, I guess I was on the road the first time I saw this on a small screen on an iPad or something like that. And it definitely holds up very well, I think, on the big screen, with or without the binaural audio.
It has the lice, the dryads, or what he was trying to call them, because he didn't want to call them lice because that's silly. It had the Indiana Jones gross out scene vibe, right? Like this is the episode of the season that has the, you know, the bugs, like you have the sequence in Temple of Doom or whatever, you know what I mean? It had that same sort of feeling.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I thought of that too, because I was actually trying to pinpoint why I wasn't creeped out by the bugs. And this might just be an effects thing, because they're obviously so clearly CGI. Whereas in Temple of Doom, those are real bugs. Like that's very, you know, there's the well before CGI and it's all practical effects. Cause I really wasn't creeped out by the bugs. I thought in terms of my creep meter, they raise it really high at the beginning. And I think it's for about the first half, it's really, really great. Once the bug shows up, I feel like it sort of starts to go down a bit. And I gotta say, Chris, I don't know if I was as scared by the people disappearing or just kind of confused, you know, like there's sort of a confusion there of like, well, wait, what exactly happened? And then again, realizing I know they can't really show gore, but it was just so sudden and weird. And then I do think it picks up a little bit when Eliza shows up in the last act. We can talk about her in a few minutes, but I think the thing that I didn't like in the whole creepiness of it is more the end, where everyone is sort of reconstituted. And that just seems so cheap to me, in that like now the horror stuff I was supposed to be scared by I is no longer going to stay with me. Now I'm just like, oh, they were kind of never really in any danger. And usually, like, even though all the criticism I have of the effects and whatever I think is valid, I think if they had kept the kids dead, yes, it's a darker ending, but that's kind of the point, right? Then it sort of stays with you.
I think that would have fundamentally changed the doctor's relationship with Bill and how Bill reacts to things. And it would have changed the meta plot significantly to have something that dark and that lethal just in a middle of an episode like this. And so like they wouldn't have been able to do that without changing the trajectory of the rest of the season.
Maybe, I don't know, but like while you're during the episode, you're thinking, oh, they're dead. Like surely you might, like, this is the first time you've seen this, right? I mean, did you think they were going to simply just be reconstituted by the end?
I have this feeling that like generally the doctor reacts more viciously when death is permanent, right? Because there is this idea that he can save everybody, right? Mm-hmm. How many great episodes end with him going, nobody dies today, and his solutions more often than not result in bringing people back, preventing their deaths in the first place, whatever. So like there's always something in the back of my mind going like, oh, they've been dissipated, there's no gore, maybe there is a chance for him to bring them back. And maybe that's just a function of my optimism or faith in the doctor, which might be misplaced. But there are definitely situations where he's gone through and done the impossible to bring those folks back in episodes, and it's been very dramatic. To your point, maybe it was
everyone lives.
Yeah, like maybe it was less dramatic here than it has been in some others, but that's always kicking in the back of my mind as far as the doctor goes.
So Brian, you're not familiar with the rest of the season.
No.
First of all, I got to ask you, you don't know who or what is in the vault, right? We have the scene.
That was very tantalizing, and that's I think part of what made Valkyrie and I both go like, we need to catch up like right now on this. Because I just I had skipped over this season specifically. And yeah, that's really something I want to know more about.
We got to commission some Capaldi trading cards from you just to make sure.
I'm going to go through them pretty quickly, actually, because Valkyrie wants to go through them now. And I'm going to strike while that iron's hot, because
love it.
Once you have her interest, she'll be all on board. So
love it. So, well, glad to know that you don't know. So Pete and I will avoid any spoilers on who or what is in the vault. I actually thought it was kind of became a little too obvious with this ending, which is something that Moffat wrote and kind of tacked on to the end.
What he mentions, like, a lot of kids die or something like that. I forget the exact line, but he's like, and it's like the delighted music that starts up is like, okay.
We hear Pop Goes the Weasel, whereas previously Fur Elise had been playing. Very interesting. Pop Goes the Weasel, maybe it's Francis Ford Coppola. And it's a Godfather reference. Who knows?
Yeah, we'll say the bookends of this story are really good. Like the mundanity of like finding the place. And it was so good the way they had that tiny house like between the two other houses. And like there's a bedroom under the stairs, like a Harry Potter bedroom, essentially, at some point. Yeah. And it's like, but that's actually real, right? Like I've seen places like that. When I was looking for places and like in my early 20s and stuff, it's like, oh yeah, this is...
There was actually a student housing shortage in Britain around this time. So it was actually playing on real headlines. But yeah, to me, the least realistic aspect of that is the notion that none of their devices could be charged from the mains, like the old power sockets.
Right.
And they were still there. Like they didn't consider that a deal breaker. That doesn't seem realistic to me with their model.
They figured they could just get an adapter.
I mean, as a father of a 20 and a 21-year-old, they're not paying attention to stuff like that. They have no idea. My kids would totally rent that place and go like, it's cheap and I can get out of the house. Like, wait a second. What do you mean I can't plug in my devices? I'll figure that out tomorrow. And then call me and go, can you figure this out for me?
Can you just deliver battery packs every day?
Yeah. No, yeah, exactly.
No, you nailed it. Like, that's exactly the mentality of early 20s. Just like, whatever. It is what it is. And it's great because it's mine. You know, I've got this place. But I also love that the TARDIS is now used as like a moving to move Bill's stuff. And again, this utterly mundane thing. And she's using her buddy with the space time ship to do it. That's what you do. Like, why not?
Who else are you going to call to help you move? I liked how she used the TARDIS's power to like bring all of her stuff in, but then was so embarrassed by him in front of her friends that she wouldn't let him bring it all the way in.
Well, let's talk about that. I really love those scenes where she's basically having him interact with her new friends that she's only known for a little bit right now at this point, but she's kind of like, all right, thanks for helping me move, bugger off. And I think it's cute. And I feel like the intent is that she's young, he's old. You're killing my buzz here, man. Take off. But I actually read that as, look, thanks for your help moving my stuff. But I know where you're around, doctor, there's trouble. And she's kind of doing this thing where it's like, I just want you out of here because I don't want trouble with these people. There's going to be trouble if you stay. There's going to be some robot or something's going to happen. And if you just leave, then everything will be fine, you know? And it's not, it's this weird sort of Doctor Who logic that I think is totally believable. But I think that's like her true motivation is that she just wants some normalcy.
The vibe I got from it was like, she wanted to wall off at least a piece of her life from him too. Right. Like that she needed something for herself. And you see that with other companions where the doctor takes over completely. And I mean, Amy and Rory had that conversation where it's like there's doctor time and not doctor time. And the longer they were with him, the more not doctor time they had. And it became more normal and mundane. And they didn't guard against that at all. Like anytime he showed up, it was just into the TARDIS with them. And so I think Bill's maybe smarter than them at that point, trying to wall off that garden from the get-go.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's definitely a thing throughout New Who, right? Nothing like this was ever explored in the old series. But with New Who, it's definitely a case of, like, each companion gets more and more of a life outside the Doctor, you know, starting even with Rose. You know, we see Rose's life before we see a life with the Doctor, and then we continue to see it. We continue to see her family and her relationship with Mickey develop, and
I would say
seems like the natural combination of that.
It's not just a New Who thing. I think it's kind of a Moffat thing, because if you think about Davies, it's kind of the reverse in certain episodes, which is to say that there's something weird afoot in whatever's going on. This is usually a setup to certain episodes. Something weird is afoot. Let's call the Doctor. You know, like, remember how Mickey is sort of keeping an eye on the school in School Reunion. Right. And even in the Moffat era, like, the Power of Three was kind of like that. You know, they had the cubes come out, and then they, you know, we need the Doctor here. And here it's like, it's clear you need the Doctor here. Like, there's a creepy landlord and the guy's missing, and you're shooing him away. Why surely you'd want him to come and investigate. But of course she's like, I think in her mind, she's sort of thinking he's the cause of that. Like, because he's here, just the simple fact of his presence, like, there's going to be alien shit. And
right.
Whether or not that's true. I mean, you know, it's more like you kind of need the Doctor now. So when she's like, you're not leaving, are you? And he's like, no.
It's definitely of a piece with that sort of denial of, like, no, this is a cheap house. Don't mess it up. Don't make it a haunted house.
It's kind of why I stumbled over it a bit in the TLDW, because it's like, I feel like this is sort of the key sort of tension and the pivot point is when that scene where she's like, you're not leaving, are you? And she kind of acquiesces to it. And thankfully she does, because, like, this is a space lice. Like, you need the Time Lord. He's going
to
deal with it.
At a certain point, your student-y denial of the problem here has to end. And it does end with that wonderful pivot point of the Doctor asking the landlord to name the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Which I thought was wonderful. And unfortunate that we have another Margaret Thatcher reference in Doctor Who, not the only one. We do not have a Margaret Thatcher bingo.
It's unfortunate we have a Margaret Thatcher reference in life.
Yes.
Hey. Sure, she has fans. Hey.
Yeah.
It's all good.
if you are a Margaret Thatcher fan, please write in. Also, if you're a Harriet Jones fan,
a good movie with her, like, it was like The Iron Lady or something. Yeah.
They can blame me. They can blame me for that. They can send the hate mail my way.
I have many things to say to Margaret Thatcher about Margaret Thatcher. We get there. I grew up in the north of England in the '80s. I have issues. But we also, it's that nice blend of, you know, real and imaginary, right? Who's the Prime Minister? Margaret Thatcher, Harriet Jones.
Yeah. Love the Harriet Jones reference.
Yes. Harriet Jones, comma, Prime Minister. And then Eden and, I forget who the other one is, Macmillan. Read about that, and he never answers who the current Prime Minister is, which is kind of a shame, because I would love to know who in current Who chronology actually is the Prime Minister at this point. And in 2017, I believe it would have been Theresa May. Hopefully it wasn't actually Theresa May in the Who universe, and they've got a fake Prime Minister in there. But yeah, we don't know. We don't get to find out. But to the other point, I just wanted to throw this in. The whole idea of the TARDIS as moving service. Now we've had this, Brian. We've sort of experienced a lot of TARDIS-rich episodes here on Porto Open. The randomizer seems to be drawing attention to the different ways that you can use the TARDIS. A lot of it is the question of whether it's a taxi service. We saw in the Peter Davison episode, Black Orchid, that the Doctor does sometimes provide taxi service to police officers. Harry Sullivan in Ark in Space mentioned the idea of using the TARDIS as a way to hide policemen in Trafalgar Square. Never quite explained why that would be useful. And Bill here is like, hey, you know, you could rent this as a moving service. But we do almost have a TARDIS materializing around people or things bingo, because it happens in Hellbent, Blink, Runaway Bride, Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, and All We Need Now is Parting of the Ways.
Oh, this is the yeah, that's right. Yeah, okay. So far.
So, yeah, so far. But Brian, as a Matt Smith fan, did you feel like this was with the wooden woman at the end kind of gives very, very Doctor Widow in the Wardrobe vibes, right?
A little bit, yeah. I was more drawn to the, like, when the Doctor made the connections to dryads and wood people and nymphs and things like that, that's kind of where my head went. So I was thinking along those lines of mythology. And if I had one disappointment, it's that he just sort of gave it that name and made it up, and they didn't thematically tie that to any stories about nymphs or dryads, because that's where I thought it was heading, to be honest. And they do that so much through the show where they'll say this alien thing is where this myth or story that you've got came from, whether that's werewolves or whatever. So I thought we were heading that direction and we didn't, but, I did get some vibes, because that's the episode where the woman from World War II sort of takes that whole spirit of the forest in her head and, you know, transports them. But I never got a sense that anything like that is what was going on. I kind of felt like it was the other way around, where they were absorbing the people rather than putting themselves in people.
Yeah, I wish they had spent a little more time. I don't want a big scene of exposition, but honestly, like, what sort of ends up happening at the end, it just doesn't really make a lot of sense. Like, why would these space bugs want to restore her? And even if they did, like, how does, you know, killing the people who come in help her? And why would they kill one and not the other? You know what I mean? I guess you could bring in a certain amount of headcanon to that and think, like, okay, she's the first thing they've encountered, so maybe they've sort of turned her into some kind of mother creature. But then why every 20 years? And then, like, how does all this, how does all this work, really, right? And why are the only the most recent six, like, brought back? Like, why not bring back everybody who has been consumed, which would be a happier ending. It'd be like, and it'd be kind of fun too, right? It'd be like seeing people from the 70s and the 50s all here. And admittedly, it would require sort of a quick, like, okay, the Doctor's got to take everybody back in time or whatever, which would probably, bring up questions of paradox.
Taxi service to take them back.
It's just, it wasn't quite enough there. I just needed a couple more lines of, like, this is why this is here. It's just more like, we wanted to do a wooden woman, which looked great, by the way. I thought the makeup and whatever sort of special effects they were doing was really excellent, especially when the bug is, like, crawling on her lip. It's, like, super creepy. So all that looked great. It just, like, why, how, just a tiny bit more, I think, would have made it a little more palatable. As it was, it's kind of a nothing burger, right? The sort of the inevitable thing happens where the bad guys get consumed and the good guys all come back. And it's sort of like, we just did that because that's how we wanted to end it. And it's like, oh, okay. Then it's just, again, like I said earlier, it just doesn't stay with you.
From a writing perspective, my guess is they figured out what the reveal at the end would be and then just reverse engineered how they could make that work without putting too much more thought into it. And, you know, watching Doctor Who, there is a certain level of disbelief that people are going to suspend because maybe we're just too human to get it and these aliens are weird and they're doing their thing or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, so maybe they were relying a little too much on that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm totally willing to go with wherever they want to go. I just want that place to be interesting and challenging, right? And I just don't think it was. I think they kind of went for the easiest, most formulaic kind of happy ending. That was also simplest, right? They just didn't want to do a complicated scene with a whole bunch of extras and have some weird questions answered about what the Doctor does to sort of fix that. They're just like, oh, no, let's just go back to the beginning, and it's kind of a reset button. And you're just going, oh, okay.
The explanation I kind of came up with in my head as I was watching it on the fly was that it took six people worth of energy to keep the house and her alive.
Yeah.
And it it got spent over 20 years, which is why they needed to replenish it. And so these people hadn't had time to be like digested, right? Like it was the wood equivalent of the Sarlacc pit, where they're going to spend 20 years getting digested, and they just hadn't been through that process yet.
Right,
and they busted out like Boba Fett.
nice reference. Nice. Yeah, I love it. That actually works for me. And yeah, I'm sad that the crew from 1977 isn't going to come back and reclaim that David Bowie album. but you know, really, someone should have saved that vinyl. It's probably worth something. But yeah, I kind of liked a lot of this. I like the fact that Capaldi is kind of. It's a really good episode for the Doctor to be kind of self-aware and self-parodying. I like the way that he said Invasion of the Triads as if it were like the title of a 1970s classic Who Hinchcliffe serial, right? And just Invasion of the Triads, like he kind of realizes that, hey, that'd be a good story.
He almost turns to camera in one of his trademark Capaldi moments. Maybe you should use that title, sir.
But it definitely continues this theme. Bill is asking all the questions that we should have been asking all along, right? The whole thing with Time Lords at the beginning, when she notes how dumb Time Lords sound. And she's like, what, they wear big hats? No, collars mostly, which is a wonderful line.
And he casually mentions... And gets
aside by saying, yeah, well, you know, this is why I ran away.
He had some of the best lines... I've seen him with, like, one of my favorites was when he's with the kid, like, locked in the kitchen, and he's like, just don't be afraid. And he's like, why? He's like, because it doesn't help. Like, that line was delivered with such a great deadpan that it was like, I'm on board with him, like, no matter what he's doing. And him blundering his way through, like, he didn't study for what's going on any more than the writer did. So him trying to talk through everything is just sort of as like, I don't know. It's like late on a Saturday and I thought I was just going to hang out and watch some, like listen to music with some kids. Like this all could happen. And it's Bill, like you said, that sort of pokes those holes and forces the reveal of who the landlord really is that felt really endearing. That felt like the point of the episode more than the alien, which is why I think I was a little bit more forgiving of how all of that worked, because they did build to such a really good moment with that.
Yeah. And it does kind of pivot right there at the end from being a horror story into really being a family story. You know, a story about a mother and a son, and which I thought was the second time around, I thought that was really effective. Like David Suchet's tears at the end, like my goodness, is just he's really, really good at weeping. I guess we didn't get that very much in Poirot.
And well, and also like as a parent, I actually really like the message of like take charge. You know, like you're ultimately responsible here, and like he's living his life to please you, and you've got to be the one to set him straight because you're the parent. I mean, I just thought it's just a nice message. And like you said, like great scene, like good effects. Even I'm not super thrilled with the entire resolution, structurally, I thought it really worked.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Star Wars is kind of a family drama in a lot of ways, right? The main series of movies. And we've got an interesting pivot of family drama here in a way that I hadn't seen before. And it is interesting, like, you know, both of you guys watch this with your daughters. Like, it's an interesting father-daughter kind of story to watch, right? Because of that reveal at the end of the, you know, the daughter is mother to the father, really. And you know, and it's ultimately all the same. It's ultimately like you do, whoever is the parent has to let the child go or encourage the child to leave the nest.
It was an interesting conversation I had with Valkyrie afterward, because I asked her point blank, I was like, would you do that? Like, if I were going to die tomorrow, like, would you do that? And she's like, no, I wouldn't want you to be wooden, but also like, that's the way things are. Like parents die and we have to let go. she's been through a lot of death as an 8-year-old. So she's like, she's been dealing with some grief, and it's been something she's been working on with a therapist. So I'm not surprised by that answer, but like, it was kind of refreshing to get. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's powerful. So yeah, Pete, how did, you were watching it with Grace?
Yeah, I watched it with Grace. Actually, I watched it with the whole family. They everybody gathers around for New Who. Grace is, I think, the only one patient enough to sit through Classic Who with me anymore. But Jack was there too. So Jack is my son. He's 13. He thought it, he liked it. Now that we're kind of the podcast family. When it cuts to credits at the end, Jack will give his review, and he just said Dalek. That was a Dalek. And Grace said it, basically she said it was okay. I think she was a little freaked out early on, just because I think the technical direction of the scares and sort of the jump scares and the timing of the sound with the creaks and all that stuff was just creepy. So she was creeped out, but I don't think she was ever fully scared. And then the end, she was, you know, just kind of noncommittal. But yeah, I got to give points to just like that, those technicalities in how they timed everything earlier on. Like, especially one of my favorite bits is when, how did they ask, they're there in that middle scene, like, how do we get to the tower? And he just, David Suchet just turns like, you don't. And it's sort of that little bit of a turn, like the little, and there's like, I think there might even be like a lightning flash at the right then or something. It just feels like there's like, oh, okay. And then, but he also like corrects himself a second later, like, oh, I was just really creepy, wasn't I? Ha ha. Everything's okay. And, you know, all those little bits early on, I think do a hell of a lot to sort of set it up. And so Grace really appreciated it. And yeah, my wife, Megan, she watched it. She thought it was a fine episode. She likes this era, Capaldi, especially even the earlier ones in RTD. So as a New Who, you know, again, everyone just thought it was kind of okay. So there's not, it's not the greatest episode ever. It has some good things in it. But you know, there
it's
are
definitely
some
a good one for like, you know, you could kind of introduce someone to Doctor Who with this, because it does showcase the fact that the Doctor uses his mind, right? Uses his skills of deduction. He's a little bit of a Sherlock Holmes character, because that's what he's doing throughout this. He's kind of like, oh, you said this. And then, you know, and he puts together the 70 years thing, to figure out the reveal.
Well, also what you said earlier, I think is a really good reason to start with something like this, which is Bill. Bill is great. She's one of the best companions to do that bridge between the regular world and the Doctor Who world. And especially that sort of questioning with him early on that we were just talking about. She milks that throughout this season. I remember we did Smile.
Yeah.
There's a ton of that in that one, where she's learning about the Doctor and this, you know, life he leads in jumping around the cosmos everywhere. And it seems like, I think every episode
of why is it a police box? Like, you know, that's tackled in Smile. And yeah, there's a lot of that.
Yeah. Bill is just such a refreshing companion. I mean, in series 10, I mean, I think most people are 9 out of 10 Whovians agree. Bill is the best 12th Doctor companion. So,
it's great that she's not just sort of the token LGBTQ character, right?
Right.
You know, it's not just like, hey, I'm here and I'm the first LGBTQ, full on, like, you know, not just implied like with Jack Harkness, but full on, yes, I like girls, you know. But she's also like, you know, got this curiosity thing going on and this knack of just zeroing in on questions that we should have been asking all along. Like,
She's got a very blue collar look at it.
Yes.
Right. If that makes sense, it's very just like, why are you doing this? Like, not putting up with the pretension that maybe some of the other companions had.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a bit Rose-like in that sense, I think.
Well, she's great at asking questions for sure. But so are we, and also answering them in a little play segment we like to call the 4 questions to Doomsday.
Knock, knock 4 times for the 4 questions.
First question, why did the randomizer take us here? What do we think?
I was just recently listening to our last episode on the mutants. I think at one point, did we mention the word lice?
Yeah, did we?
I seem to remember we mentioned lice.
Why did we? Because everyone's hair was long? Why did we say lice?
I don't. Oh, yeah. Was it the Professor Songard with the bald head? We're like, oh, at least he doesn't have to worry about lice. Yeah,
that's probably him.
Okay. So that makes sense. But we have had a bit of a bug thing going on, as I mentioned. Like, we had the Wurren in Arkan Space. The mutants turn into, you know, bugs and then butterflies. So I got to ask, is the randomizer an entomologist? Is that's what's going on here? Not just, you know, the randomizer seems to have certain preferences. One of them is Capaldi. The other is episodes with curious uses of the TARDIS. And another, I think we're discovering now, is bugs. Randomizer loves bugs.
It's liking the bugs. So there's definitely that connection to the Arkan Space. There's the Harry Sullivan thing you mentioned. And by the way, I'm really glad they didn't do that, because there's really, I mean, presumably if they were going to do it, they would put some lines in it. But I just feel like it's kind of the dumbest thing to name the guy the same name as Harry Sullivan. Yes. Like, they're both named Harry. It's like, okay, I guess you could, you know, again, argue. But if you're not
going to find that out, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, Harry, how is it even a thing, right? It's like, it's kind of like, to my, remember when we did, the Doctor, the Widow, and the Wardrobe, and I was hard on that episode for making an Androzani reference with literally only to make an Androzani reference. And I feel like, you know, notwithstanding what they might have written if they had gone that way, but it feels like this would have been that. Let's just make a Harry Sullivan reference for the sake of it. And not even in a sort of a clever oblique way like they do in the Zygon inversion, where he sort of just says the name imbecile, and it's more of a implication than a outright reference. So maybe I guess, like, if you think about it, if they did do that, Harry Sullivan would have been the most referenced former companion of the Capaldi era.
So there's that we did the Zygons, and there's that Harry reference. Yeah, the randomizer is low-key a Harry Sullivan fan.
And I guess the other thing I would say is, like, in the mutants, I feel like there was a point we talked about how Pertwee was taking his duty of care seriously with Joe, which was a nice sort of undertone of that episode. And I feel like there's a lot of that here. I feel like him being, you know, her quote unquote Bill's grandfather or whatever, like, this is basically what he's doing here. He's looking out for her and refusing to leave and, you know, solving this problem, which needs solving, even though she's trying to sort of, you know, shoo him. So, I think there's a little bit of a parallel there in terms of how he regards his companions and his duty to them in both.
Yeah, and the grandfather reference, obviously a nice callback to Susan, the very first companion. We still don't know anything about the grandfather-granddaughter relationship there, but it might be nice to kind of throw in a reference to that, like, oh, no, don't call me grandfather. You know, that brings up all sorts of associations. I don't know how you would write that in, but... But yeah, nice.
So before moving on to the second question, Brian, I know you haven't been accompanying us on our entire random journey, but just wanted to throw it out to you if you had any ideas on why the randomizer might have taken here, not necessarily making connections to what we've done, but maybe like why Knock Knock would be a good thing to watch now here in July 2023. Well,
I think I might have had something to do with it. It was funny, like when Chris asked me to come on, I've been really busy on deadlines, and he was like, well, the randomizer's got this, like, you know, huge epic Classic Who series, and I don't have the surface to get the Classic Who stuff right now. And he's like, well, I'll just let you know the next time we're in the era, and the chances of it picking one of the 10 episodes I haven't seen seems absurd. And so it was just to get me to go, you know, light a fire under me. And get me to go finish
picking an episode that Valkyrie likes as well.
Yeah.
To get her into it. So that's wonderful. When the randomizer does this, it creates new fans. It actually, when we went to the Doctor's Wife, if you remember our guest that time, from the Doctor Who show, Dave, he was, you know, he'd rage quit the series at that point. Right. So got him back into it. So yeah, the randomizer is kind of just sort of making new Who fans, reviving Who fandom all around. It's kind of it's dispensing little bits of Who joy everywhere. So thank you,
randomizer. Yeah,
it's prescient, if nothing else.
I will also say one more thing there, which is that we've been at a number of Pertwee episodes, and we always associate Pertwee with being, you know, stuck on Earth. And here we go from Pertwee not being stuck on Earth, right?
You know, right.
In two space episodes, like before and after the Three Doctors, before he's liberated from his exile, with contrasting that with a Capaldi episode from the season where he is kind of, you know,
right.
deliberately
stuck on Earth, and then deliberately giving himself missions throughout, even though he's stuck on Earth.
So I love that comparison. Good job, randomizer.
All right, moving on to the second question, which is, what if the evil plot had succeeded?
So, okay, so right. If the evil plot succeeds, the Doctor and Bill are consumed, right?
You'd think that, right? Because that's, like I say, when we think about these evil plots succeeding, I like to think about the last thing that happens, or close to it, that the final turn that the heroes win, and it just doesn't work. So presumably, for whatever reason, the bugs are too quick, they consume the Doctor and Bill, and that would mean the bugs just absorbed a Time Lord, which I think is a big X factor here, right? Because now she's got Time Lord energy, Eliza. So how does that change things? So now, like, does she become a true evil tyrant person that wants to take over the world or something? Or
is she suddenly revealed to be Jodie Whittaker?
Oh, a wooden Jodie Whittaker.
A wooden Jodie Whittaker.
Yeah. Which, how could you tell the difference? Oh, sorry. Sorry, that's a joke, Jodie. No.
Better than the stone, almost as good as the stone Jodie Whittaker in the in Flux. The Weeping Angel version.
That's a good one.
Yeah, so that could be interesting. We could get a bit of a dark Time Lord situation. Brian, what do you think?
Well, I get the idea that, like, if the evil plan would have succeeded, Eliza didn't have an evil plan. She wasn't actually part of that. So it would have been the son, David Suchet's character, sending the bugs after them, and then her trying to control them, and then that not working. So maybe she has less control over that. And if he can control the bugs, and he can control, all of a sudden they have all the energy from a Time Lord, and he realizes there's something different with them, that maybe he can do something to advance his goals. And it's much more low stakes than, you know, a dark wooden Time Lord. But his evil plan is that he just keeps his mother alive for the next 600 years. And the tragedy is that he's going to die before she does at that point.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, that is the point. Like, he's not got any Time Lord energy himself. He's not going to regenerate. He's on his last legs.
And his evil plan is just to keep his mom alive.
Well, yeah. Could he not then get the bugs to turn himself into a wooden immortal thing, and then sort of be his, you know, mother son together forever in that sense? Or no?
Yeah, maybe the Time Lord energy gives him enough power to turn wooden as well. Or maybe we just get a wooden Capaldi, right? Where they can't consume him entirely. They just turn him into a wooden thing, and then he's stuck there in the house.
Yes, and then he goes into a wooden TARDIS and into the old control room with its wooden panels, and vows vengeance on the space lice. Or maybe we get a wooden Valyard. Maybe we get one of these interstitial regenerations.
Maybe they convince the trees of the world to grow again, like they did in the Forest of the Night. And then it's like Woodworld. You know, yeah. Like, it's basically, that's how they end up taking over and turning Earth into some kind of wood empire. I don't know.
Or maybe this is the beginnings of the Forest of Cheem.
Love it. Yes. Well, either way, we you know, instant solution for climate change, as we talked about in the Forest of the Night, like, just grow enough trees, suck in enough CO2, and it's not an evil plot. It's actually fixing the planet.
All right. You just got to get wood, I guess, for that to happen.
Oh, no.
You knew I was
I guess we got through a whole hour of the episode without making a wood joke. So it had to happen.
We have to move on. Yes. That joke is a signal we have to go
move on. Before we move on, we should say that who or what in the vault would then not be released in that situation.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, which would kind of mess things up.
A little bit.
In an interesting way. Anyway, but we won't reveal.
Yeah.
For Brian's sake, we won't reveal who or what that is. So anyway, time to move on.
Time to move on to the third question. Where is the Clara Splinter? Clara Oswald, of course, splintered in time at the end of the name of the Doctor. She is somewhere in every single story. Where is she here in Knock Knock?
Well, she might be basically doing cleanup here on the fact that there's suddenly this large piece of real estate with a bunch of trash on it. You know, with people asking questions about, well, hey, who owns this area now? Could we maybe build some student housing on it?
With proper outlets?
Yeah, exactly. Can we get the electricity up to code this time? Yeah, maybe less creaky floorboards.
I don't mind that. It's kind of mundane, but that's kind of the episode. So
that's kind of where we're at. Yeah, she's a real estate agent. Comes in, snaps it up.
See, I was thinking she's like a neighbor to that castle place, and she's the most not nosy neighbor in the world. Like, she doesn't care that basically no one lives there, and every 20 years a bunch of people move in and you never see them again, and she just doesn't ask questions and just completely covers for it if she needs to. Conversely, she might even be the incompetent investigator who's looked into each of these disappearances, even though they've happened at the same house every 20 years, and has not been able to put two and two together as to maybe we should keep an eye on this dude and see what he's doing in the tower there. Is that a good idea? And it's like, no, I'm sure he's fine. He's on the up and up. It's all good. Moving on.
Yeah, she might be like the case officer assigned to this weird family situation.
Yeah, and she's 72, right? So she's super old and just can't be bothered.
Part of the whole thing about Clara going into his timeline, he's not really in any mortal danger in this episode. She just has to keep putting him on the right path, right? So maybe she was the previous possible tenant who was like, no, this is a terrible idea, like before Bill and her friends showed up, just to make sure they got it so the Doctor would be there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she's dissuading everyone else from renting it. She's nudging the landlord into being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Just to resolve all of this. Maybe she has a spare key and that's how the Doctor gets in the first place, because we do find him basically in the broom closet at one point. No real explanation for how he's got in there.
I like the explanation of her being dissuading everyone, because actually it makes sense now why this would come in the middle of the school year, it seems like, right? Because I think the beginning of the season is more earlier, like that's more like September, and now we're like a few episodes in. You think, well, housing would have been pretty much resolved at this point, but maybe Clara for the last few weeks has been like, as soon as they're about to sign the lease, tap you on the shoulder, actually, you don't want that, because look into the past here, and the groups of six kids have been disappearing from this place for the past 70 years or so. So don't do that. And then she just like waits for this group. She's like, all right, now we're good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Putting up flyers around the house, warning people away from it. And then taking the flyers down just as Bill and her group come along.
All right. Yeah. Flyer Clara. Good stuff. So we're going to have to move on now to the final question, the ultimate question, the only question that matters for Knock Knock. What did we think of this story? So the Pull to Open rating system has 5 ratings. There is the Dalek, which we give to a good episode of Doctor Who. The Ogron, which we give to a not so good episode of Doctor Who. The Professor Hayter, which was an episode that may not be that great, but hey, at least they tried something. At least we learned something. The Viscount Banger, which we reserve for the best of the best. And the rarely used Fixed Point in Time, which of course is a rating that we give to episodes we simply cannot rate. It's beyond rating. It's something we give sometimes for reasons of nostalgia, but also for other reasons occasionally. All right. So what do we think, guys? Chris, why don't you go first and we'll save Brian's for last.
I think on initial viewing, I would have rated this a no gron, and I think I'm actually going to upgrade it to a low level Dalek. I think it kind of, it set out its stall. It did what it intended to do. It's, you know, it is a kind of a mid episode of Doctor Who, as the kids say, but it's very mid, but also, yeah, it's a Dalek. Like I don't think, like, with its limited ambition of like, we're going to do Haunted House, we're going to do Space Lies, like it kind of, you know, kind of met it. I think the problems of Knock Knock are not necessarily the problems of execution. I think it's just that it's kind of a, you know, mundane bottle episode in itself, but that's not a bad thing. They can't all be Viscount bangers. So yeah, I'm going to give it a low Dalek on the totem pole. Definitely not an Emperor or Supreme Dalek, but a Dalek nonetheless.
That's good. You know, you're kind of, I think I convinced you last week to switch your rating from an Ogron to like a Professor Hayter.
Yes.
You're kind of convincing me this week to change my Professor Hayter to a Dalek. I'll have to talk it out loud to know if I'm doing that or not. But I was thinking, I went into this commentary, this podcast, thinking I'm going to give this to Professor Hayter because I do have issues with how the story is resolved. I really do think bringing all the kids back at the end is kind of a cop-out. And it robs the story of any weight that it could have had. So, but that said, you know, you're right that, hey, not everything needs to be a weighty, high-protein meal, right? Like, you can have a Tic Tac every now and then. And I would sort of regard this as kind of a Tic Tac. And I think what you said in the script not really having the ambition in the first place to give you something weighty, I think you're right. And it's okay. And I'm with you. So you've done it. You've convinced me that this is a good episode of Doctor Who. It's not the most weighty episode of Doctor Who, but you know what? Everything we talked about with Bill, a relationship with the Doctor, all that fun Haunted House stuff early on, all that works. And it probably doesn't go in the best direction for every fan, but hey.
Self-aware story, I think. Yeah. It's self-aware in many ways, both in the sense that, like, the kids kind of know that they're in a horror movie, right? They're making constant references to it, which I guess is kind of a thing in horror movies these days. Like, in Cabin in the Woods did that.
All post-Scream, I feel like.
Yeah.
Like, once you get post-Scream, everything got meta. Layers of meta stacked on each other. So, yeah, you kind of have to do it.
I did that. Brian, what do you think?
I'm definitely in Dalek territory. Maybe it's one of Winston Churchill's Daleks, but it's David Suchet actually really makes this episode more than anything. Like, the Bill stuff is great. Capaldi's work is great. The technical ability to actually create the creepy atmosphere was really good, but so much of that leans on David Suchet's performance, and then it feels like the entire script was built around the reveal, and without his performance there, it wouldn't work. And it does so well. And he sort of reverts very capably into a lost little boy. And that through line through all of it is actually what drew me most to it, more than the horror, more than the relationship between the Doctor and his companion. It was his guest starring sort of, that was really the workhorse of this episode. But the other thing I really liked about it was the fact that it really stretches the form of a Doctor Who episode, right? Like, this is the only show where you can have a hard sci-fi, a fantasy story, a horror story, a mundane story about the everyday, and then sometimes you can blend all of that. Right. And so it really it kind of exemplified what a pretty average middle tier episode of Doctor Who can be. And that's not a bad thing. If you can get an average sort of Doctor Who episode, that's better than most things on TV.
Nice. Yeah. You know, you don't really have the move-in episode of The Mandalorian to my to my knowledge, if you had to do that.
Maybe we could have had that like the end of season three when they get their new their new abode. Just see them walking in at the end when we iris out, like just they're both carrying boxes.
Well, John Favreau's a fan of the podcast, so I'm sure he's saying challenge accepted.
Love it.
That's Love awesome. It. But no,
he's like, okay, Dan.
What you were saying there, Brian, I really like what you said about like only Doctor Who can really pull this off. Like all this combination of genres and sort of plot tropes and whatever. Like, yeah. That's
I think
you've nailed like one of the reasons we love this show, and you know, we're actually the only people podcasting about it, I believe.
I think that's a harder balance to strike than people watching the show. I mean, coming from a background of storytelling, hitting the tone correctly for one genre at a time is hard enough. Mm-hmm. Blend four of them, and then have that through line of tone work as well as it does in this episode is actually sort of a miracle. That it turned out as well as it did speaks very well of just what Doctor Who can do as a medium for telling stories like this.
Yeah. And Brian, I think you're absolutely right about David Suchet really making the episode. You reminded me that my sister's kryptonite in any form of entertainment is old men crying. So I asked her what she thought of this, because my goodness, he really, really sells that, you know, eyes full of tears thing at the end and in the reveal.
Beautiful moment. I have to ask her in a future podcast, because folks, we're rapidly approaching the end of this one as we say goodbye to Knock Knock and enter the randomizer to find out where we're going next.
The randomizer, composed of two elements. First of all is the codex, or the list of Doctor Who stories in not random order, which Peter's at the controls of. And this is the new upgraded codex, which spits out immediately the number of Doctor Who stories that we have not been to. Pete, what is that number?
A number, now that I am ticking off Knock Knock, is at
213. Wow. Getting ever closer to that 200. I could taste it. And then the second component, the Executor, is played by random.org, which our guest Brian Young is going to man for us today, the actual random element, bespoke randomness. Randomness from the atmosphere, from atmospheric noise, from space lice bouncing around up there in the stratosphere, rather than algorithmic randomness, which computers are just terrible at guessing at random numbers. So, Brian, if you would go to random.org and plug in the numbers 1 and 213, and then
don't hit the button.
Yeah, hit the button yet, because we have some challenges. We have challenges for the randomizer. We like to tempt fate by issuing requests, questions, desires, and maybe even psychological tricks to reverse psychologize the randomizer into going where we want. Pete, what do you got for the randomizer this week?
Well, before Brian takes us to our 101st podcast, I'm going to ask the randomizer to give us a little more on family, because I think that was a good theme at the end of this, and the relationship between father and daughter. It's definitely something that comes up. I mean, not in all storytelling, but certainly in Doctor Who. And bring us to something that shows us another dimension of family. Let's do that.
The randomizer kind of like Susan. We've gotten a lot of those early Hartnell episodes. So maybe this is it. Maybe this is the time that we get an unearthly child. That's an interesting suggestion. I like that idea. I'm going to say let's showcase the ability of Doctor Who to be many, many things and not just horror. Let's go to a story that has no horror in it whatsoever. No hiding behind the sofa, something more cerebral, something different, at least a different genre, something that, that the series rarely tries, where it kind of stretched itself little bit, and let's see what you can make of that randomizer.
Nice.
Brian, where would you like to send us?
I think those are great suggestions, so I'm gonna hit the button.
Let's do it. I'll give you a countdown, okay?
Okay.
Ready? All right.
Yep.
In 4, 3, 2, 1.
Emergency temporal shift.
212.
Whoa, are you kidding me? Can you guess it, Chris?
Oh my god. Oh my god, that means it's gotta be Legend of the Sea Devils.
Legend of the Sea Devils! Nice.
All right.
Look at that.
Yes.
Wow.
Definitely different genre. Pirates.
That's the pirates, right?
It's pirates. The randomizer's been on a pirate kick, and Brian, you may not know this, but we have a curse on the podcast since there was a point where we were supposed to go to Curse of the Black Spot, and we kind of misread the number and went to the Unquiet Dead instead. But here, that we're one step closer, I think, to that curse being lifted by doing another pirate story.
And another Whitaker story.
Another Whitaker story. We've done the Smugglers. Yeah. And of course, this was famous in Pulled to Open History because I had not watched it for many, many, many episodes. And it almost became a segment in itself, asking me if I had finally watched it. So
almost.
Here we go.
It was like our most popular segment for that year. It's crazy. That's Christine, Legend of the Sea Devils.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, folks are going to hear all about Legend of the Sea Devils in our next podcast. But folks, before then, hey, why don't you go ahead and subscribe to this one if you haven't already? So go ahead and hit that follow button, hit that subscribe button. Go ahead and leave a review, share the podcast with a friend. You can also follow us on social at PultoOpen63 on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, or PultoOpen, all one word, on TikTok. Hey, Spotify listeners, we just rated Knock Knock. Now you can have your voice. Don't forget to rate Knock Knock in your app. You can call it a Dalek, Viscount Banger. You could call it an Ogron, whatever you like. We need more Ogron representation. No, not just saying. But go ahead and do that. Hey, Brian, where can people find you online?
Just about anywhere on social media or wherever. If you look up Swankmotron, that's where you can find me on Twitter, Blue Sky. Well, you can't find anybody on Twitter these days. Blue Sky, Instagram, wherever, and it's swankmotron.com. And if you're interested in hearing me talk about Star Wars with a similar level of passion, that would be fullofsith.com, or you can listen to Full of Sith wherever you get podcasts.
Awesome. Another great podcast to follow. All right, folks, this has been great. We will see you next time for Legend of the Sea Devils. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Chris.
Oh, thank you both.
Talk soon.
See you guys on the high seas.